just want to, as you're getting yourselves comfortable again for the talk, because we have so many monks and nuns, and you'd all be wondering, where do they all come from? What are they doing here? I'll now pass over to Ajahn Sujato, who is from south of Sydney, in a town called Bundanoon, which is the first place in the whole of Australia to ban bottled water. Is this banned as well? This is bottled water. But we bottle it ourselves from the tap. And that's halfway between Canberra and Sydney. A good friend who's spent a long time here in Perth and visits very regularly. So Ajahn Sujato, who used to be a rock musician, and he did actually get an album published, and he got even royalties from it, I remember. So from a rock musician to a rock monk. So we've got some more monks coming. I've been more. So would you like to please... No need, please just sit down. It's very good. To the Buddha. Would you like to introduce all the monks?
Okay. So good evening, everybody. So just to, by way of introduction, my name is Bhante Sujato, and I'm here... with these venerables, we're at a conference being held at Murdoch University at the moment, Buddhism in Australia. And it's a wonderful conference, extremely diverse, as you can see, and organised by a wonderful group of the Estonian Nyingma group, who've done an amazing job. So my pleasure this evening is to introduce all of the monastics here. Now... Okay, so I'm just looking down at the end. Okay, so on the end, on the far side over here, and I have to look at this piece of paper because I can't remember everybody's names and everything. Okay, so on the far side we have Venerable Sayadaw Wangsopa, and he's the assistant to the Sangharaja in Vientiane in the Sangha College in Laos. Next to him we have Venerable Uttamo Ditti Sampanno, and he's from Indonesia, studying in Thailand at the moment, from the Buddhayana, one of the groups of Buddhism in Indonesia. Next to him is Venerable Piset, studying at the Mahachulalongkorn University in Bangkok, and Venerable Piset is from Cambodia. Next to him, Venerable Dhammakamo, who is from Singapore, currently staying at Bodhnyana. And next to him is an old monk called Ajahn Brahm, who's no one special. He doesn't have anything special qualities to talk about. Okay, next to him... next to him is Venerable Freeman, and he's going to hate me for this, but he was the winner of the Triple J Youth Award a couple of years ago, so he's been doing some wonderful work for the Dhamma in Melbourne, belonging to the FPMT tradition of the Gelug School of Tibetan Buddhism. Next to him is Venerable Weishan, who is from the Renmin University of China, and he is also visiting to give a talk at the conference. Next to him is Venerable Dr. Yuan Liu, pardon my Chinese pronunciation, Venerable from the Buddhist Academy, also from China. So these Venerables are part of the, I guess, resurgence and revitalization of Buddhism in China, which is hopefully going along at the moment. Venerable, at the end, I don't know your name, but you're from Bodhinyana, yeah? Yeah. Oh, from Korea. And your name? Lokayata. Okay, Venerable Lokayata. Myself, Sujato, we've already introduced. And sitting next to me, Venerable Dr. Ashin Ketu, one of the senior teachers in Pali and Sanskrit studies in the State Pariyati Sasana University in Yangon in Myanmar. Now, I have to add this as a way of introduction to say that when, if you look at how the Buddha taught all of his suttas, he always left the most important things to the end. Right? So at the end, Venerable Bhikkhuni Jampa Sedran, who was one of the senior Tibetan Bhikkhunis, and is a very wonderful scholar of Buddhism, particularly expert in the Bhikshuni Vinaya in the Tibetan translation of the Mulasarvasivada Vinaya, but also has a wide range of expertise in many other things, as we have been finding out. And Venerable Jampa Sedran is a member of the Tibetan Committee of Western Bhikkhunis, who's been working towards the re-establishment of the Bhikkhuni order within the Tibetan tradition. And she was instrumental in organizing the Bhikkhuni Congress in Hamburg in 2006, which the Dalai Lama attended. Sorry? 2007, okay. 2007, thank you. And it's that German precision. If you're from Australia, it's like 2006, who cares, 2007, whatever. Anyway, we've clarified that, 2007, which the Dalai Lama attended, and which was, I think, very, you know, a major milestone in the movement towards the establishment of the Bhikkhuni Sangha. So that's that.
We also have the Venerable Professor from Sri Lanka as well, who's also here on the...
Venerable Hema Gunatileka, not Venerable yet, who has...
Yes, about time.
I should have introduced her, but she has been one of the, again, very supportive for establishing actually many things. She wrote the first Pali grammar in Cambodian. Yeah. And many other important works she's done to support Buddhism, including being one of the major supporters of the re-establishment of the Bhikkhuni order in Sri Lanka. And I was wondering about this earlier. I don't know, Hema, if you can answer me this, but why is it that you've given so much support for re-establishing Bhikkhuni ordination, but you haven't taken Bhikkhuni ordination yourself yet? Not yet. Okay.
Okay, very good. So thank you, Ajahn Sujata, for introducing the band today. And I'm apparently the lead singer, so I'm giving the talk this evening. And as you all know, that you make up the talks as you go along, and obviously the talk today would be, you know, on harmony and just how wonderful it is to get Buddhists from many different countries, different traditions, different genders, different ideas, but just working together in such peace and harmony, really being brothers and sisters together. And that's a very wonderful thing that we can actually see, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, that we don't have these splits and schisms. Maybe there was some years ago, some centuries ago, but we're really working hard to actually to express that sense of friendship togetherness, because in our present world there are too many divisions between peoples, divisions between religions, races, genders, whatever, divisions which create too much disharmony and mistrust and violence and all sorts of terrible consequences. And I've often taught in multi-faith conferences, if people of religion can't work together, there's not much hope for the world. We're supposed to be the moral leaders of this world. And if we can't get our acts together and be friends, then it's pretty sad. So it's incumbent upon all people of good morality, religion, faith, no matter what your faith is, to be able to work together in peace and harmony, to show the way in our modern world that we can unite and work together. But of course, you know how difficult that is. You know, sometimes you can't even work together with your own husband or wife. So you can imagine with religions it's even more difficult. But there is a way of doing that. And one of the ways of doing that, one of the stories which I like teaching, and I just taught this thing very recently, I remember some years ago being invited to Christ Church Grammar School here in Perth, a very sort of top school, to teach the morning assembly, because they wanted to have people from different religions teaching there. And so I got invited one morning to teach the morning assembly at the Christ Church Grammar School. And the chaplain there is a good friend, Frank Sheehan. And he met me outside with the principal, and the three of us had to wait outside while the teachers settled all the students. And as we were waiting outside, the principal turned to me and said, "This is a Christian school. We have a little Christian shrine, you know, in the main hall. Because, you know, the canon and I are both Christians, we do a little bow to the shrine. But you're a Buddhist monk. Please feel free not to bow. You don't have to bow at all." And I used that as an opportunity to make a point. I said, "No, I demand my right to bow to the Jesus shrine." And of course, it was unexpected. And I remember the principal said, "Now, what is this monk up to?" And then I explained to him just how I can bow to a shrine of Jesus, to a shrine of Muhammad, or whatever, because I can see something in those beings which I can respect. I don't agree with everything, otherwise I wouldn't be a Buddhist. I'd be a Christian or a Muslim. But you can always see something in there which you respect and value. And I said, "I'm going to bow to that." And that became part of the talk to the kids in that assembly, to say that in order to create harmony, you can always find something, you know, in all people, in all beings even, which you can respect. And once you see that part of them which you can respect and love even, and value, that is the secret of getting harmony. If you look at the differences, the things you don't agree with, the things which you argue with, the things which you dislike, that is the cause for disharmony, for anger and this terrible violence which sometimes comes when anger just gets into frustration, you never work it out. But if we can just turn our attention around from just seeing the faults in each other to seeing that which we value and respect, then we can have a beautiful sense of harmony, you know, in our communities. And so whenever I go to any different sort of religion, that's exactly what I do. I deliberately set my mind up to seeing something in that other person from a different faith, from a different culture, from a different tradition, something which I can really, really respect. And you know, it's not that hard to do. And of course, I've done that not just when I meet people of different religions, but meet from people of totally different ethical standards. You know, when you go to talk to lawyers, when you go to... be careful. when you go into prison and talk to prisoners and people who have murdered, when you go and talk to top business people or whatever, you know, as a Buddhist monk, you do go to see people from all different walks of life, and whenever you do go there, you try and find something you respect in that other person, because once you see that which you respect in another person, that which you value, then you have that opportunity to create that connection, that harmony, to listen to each other. And also you can see the other person, they relax, they lose their defensiveness, and you build up that friendship. It's an easy thing to do. It's a thing which I think more of us should do. Those people who are enemies. I remember reading this story about this Buddhist practitioner in the United States who was going to some sort of appointment, and he went into the elevator, and in the elevator with him came this bikie with tattoos, really violent looking, you know, just this real like monster, you know, in this elevator. And he thought, "My goodness, what am I going to do? If I look the wrong way at this bikie, you know, he will knife me, he will punch me. He's a big guy, I'm only a small guy." Because the reputations of such people were very violent. But instead of seeing, you know, the leathers, you know, the studs, you know, the thing in the back, whatever his bikie gang was, whatever they saw, instead of looking at that, which would give rise to fear and give rise to a sense of disharmony with this person, he looked at something else in that person, something, again, he could respect, his humanity. Underneath those leathers was a human being. Underneath those tattoos, there was the same blood and bones and fears which he had. And so he just started talking to that bikie, just not as a bikie, but as a person, seeing him as a human being. And then by the time they got to their respective floors, they were shaking hands, "Have a great day, mate. Yeah, all the best to you too." And there was no fear there. There was a sense of harmony and connection because he'd managed to see something in the other person instead of what would create fear, something which would create trust. And all it means is just changing one's perceptions, the way one looks at another person. But it's not just the way we use that with people in our world. It's also the way we use that to create harmony in our life. Because sometimes we have a sense of disharmony, disconnect, say, with our history, with what's happened to us. There's, you know, every week you always get lots of emails of people who are having problems and troubles. And instead of actually answering those emails, it's much better to sort of give a talk and refer people here so you can, you know, answer everything just in an evening talk. I know that sometimes people said that's killing two birds with one stone, but I hate that simile because we're Buddhists. We don't kill two birds, not even one bird. So please change the similes. These days we call it cutting two carrots with one knife. It's a much better simile because it's great, actually, as Buddhism grows in Western worlds, actually to change these bad Western similes like killing two birds with one stone, cutting two carrots with the same knife. Or that other simile, which, you know, I really dislike, where they say, you know, you give a person the fish and you feed them for one day, but you teach a person to fish and they kill fish for the rest of their life and make a lot of bad karma. That's really, really bad. So please change the simile to be something more Buddhist. You give a person a carrot, you feed them for one day. You teach a person how to grow a veggie garden, and you feed them for the whole life. Now, that's no more Buddhist. You know, we should get Buddhist culture into these terrible sayings. But anyway, to be able to I can't stop myself now, because as soon as I mention carrots, I can't forget my favourite carrot joke. Somebody reminded me of this last week, and I got an obsession with jokes. And there was these two carrots walking down the street of Perth, when unfortunately one of them got hit by a drunk driver. It's terrible, you know, the alcohol problems in our world, and when somebody gets hit by a drunk driver, it's terrible. But anyway, his friend, you know, the carrot which wasn't injured, you know, quickly rang up 000, and the emergency ambulance came along. They took one look at the injured carrot, gave him CPR, put him straight back in the ambulance. His friend went to the hospital with him. When they got to, you know, Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital, it was straight into the emergency department and straight into surgery. He was very, very badly injured. And his friend Mr. Carrot, had to stay in the waiting room. If you've ever been in that waiting room, you know, expecting news, not knowing what's going to happen, it's a very, very tense place. After 2 hours, the doctor came out and said, you know, your friend, Mr. Carrot, I've got some good news and bad news for you. The good news is we've saved his life. He's going to live. The bad news is because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. That's one of the worst jokes. It's very funny. Anyway, actually, you know, that is a wonderful way of also creating harmony in our world. Because, you know, you tell a stupid joke like that, and it doesn't matter what religion you are from, everybody laughs in the same way. The Muslim, Jew, doesn't matter how fundamentalist or extremist they are, everybody laughs at a funny joke. So it's one way of expressing our humanity together, the fact that we can laugh. And again, it's just the human condition, the funniness of our lives. And instead of actually getting angry at each other, telling a joke when people are getting upset is a very beautiful way of short-circuiting so the distrust we have between people. Because when we laugh together. When we argue against people. So the more laughter in our world, the greater harmony we will have as well. But more importantly, it's actually getting harmony, as I was mentioning earlier, with, you know, our life. You know, because, yeah, there are some things we disagree with in life, especially disagree with your past and what's happened to you. But if we can learn how to live together in harmony with people of different ideas and people we, you know, sometimes disagree with, maybe we can use the same skills to learn how to live in harmony with our past. How do we do that? again, to seeing something in what's happened to us which we can value, we can respect, no matter what that was which happened to you in your life. For example, you might have lost a child. How can you look at that and see something you value in it? It's not that hard to do, as you've heard me say before. You value the fact you've had that child for such a long time. The being has come to visit you in your life, given you so much love and joy and happiness. Thank you for coming to visit me for those few years. What a wonderful gift it was. It would have been much better if you could have stayed much longer, but it's much better those few years than none at all. You just turn your perception around and see something which you can value. And then you can find harmony with the past. It's amazing just how using Buddhist psychology, no matter what happened to you in the past, it's amazing how you can, with a bit of courage and compassion, find something to value in your experiences, no matter what they were. I can't go past, you know, one of the stories. I usually say stories from my own life because that's personal. That's something which I can relate to and I know, obviously, very deeply. Can't go past, you know, my own father's story. I often mention him in these talks because he was a very good influence on my life, a very positive influence on my life. But I never learned until I was much into my adolescence, just before he died, just how difficult his own life was, because he was a victim of parental abuse. And he told me just that his own father, who died of TB in Liverpool during the Second World War, his own father was a drunkard who would, after work every day, go to the pub, get drunk, and come back with violence, would take off his belt and just whip any of these brothers or sisters who just happened to be there for no reason at all. And then what really upset my father was when he would turn on his defenseless mother and seeing his mother being beaten by his father. That was just such an awful thing to bear, much worse than feeling the belt on your own flesh, so he said. But what he did in that, from that terrible experience of abuse, what he decided to do was to make that resolution that whenever he had children, if he did have children, he would never do the same. He actually learned from that experience and became a very, very kind father. He just couldn't hit us. He couldn't hit us, no matter, you know, we deserved it many times. We're naughty, you know. We're very, very naughty. I remember one of the naughtiest things I did was actually to, when I was about 10 or 11, there was a fashion in London of having this East London dish of eels and mash, potatoes. They'd have these eels, which they would boil up, and serve them with mashed potato and gravy. It was sort of disgusting, but it was just a fashion at the time. And there was an eels and mash shop opened up not far from where we lived. And so one day, on my mother's birthday, I went to the shop and bought an eel, a live one. And I put it in a box and covered it up with birthday paper. I did this. And I don't know how I kept a straight face. I put a nice ribbon on it. And imagine a 10 or 11 year old son saying, "Here you are, Mummy. Happy birthday." And when, I can't forget this. When she opened it, even the people in the next suburb could hear the screams. What a nasty thing to do to your mother. But I was a small little boy like that, and you know, you wouldn't get punished for that. It was a sense of my father couldn't do anything like that because he just told me not to do it again. And that was all I needed. So what happened there is because of his abuse, what he'd experienced, he'd managed to see some value in that, to actually to incorporate it into his experience and into his cause for compassion and wisdom in life. That story which I've given many times of the truckload of dung, just when you do experience pain and difficulty in your life, when you realize that that is dung, that is shit, that is very smelly and terrible thing, you can always use that to create wisdom and compassion in your life. It doesn't matter what's happened to you. You can see some value in it. It's fertilizer for your wisdom and compassion, like my father did to become a really great father and a very wise man. I don't think he would have got that compassion and wisdom if he hadn't gone through that lessons from hell, as you might call them. So by seeing value in those things, you can come to peace with them. You can be in harmony with them. It's the same that when you look for your future, yeah, you have all anxieties and fears of what might happen. But I don't know that sometimes we think if this happens and if that happens, the future is so uncertain. I developed this new twist on a word when they say, like in religion, that the future is ineffable. Ineffable is this word meaning you can't really predict it. And I changed that around to say it's ineffable. Not ineffable, ineffable. When you keep on saying, well, if this happens, then I'll do that. If that happens, I'll do something else. Look, all these ifs, what might happen? You might go ifing around for the whole of your life. But still, you know, you will not be able to predict the future. So, you know, the future is ineffable, which means that you just let go of saying all these ifs. If something happens, if something else happens, if the worst happens, if I lose all my money on the stock market, if I get cancer, if the biopsy turns out to be negative, you know, if I die, if my husband leaves me, if my wife sort of finds another sort of toy boy, you know, if something happens, I don't know what happens, but there's so many ifs in this world, but it's a total waste of time because the future is ineffable. And that makes life so much more peaceful. Then I can be in harmony with the future. Just allow it to be, because I don't know what's going to happen, but I know whatever happens, I can always make use of it. And that's a very beautiful thing in life. I wrote to someone recently that, look, in my experience, I think this is probably the same as your experience, when I make, sometimes I want to make plans, I just try and decide what I'm going to do, because, you know, if you don't make plans, things go wrong. But then when I do make plans, they go wrong anyway. So when you really think about it, you make plans and they go wrong. You don't make plans, they go wrong. It's a waste of time making plans. Either way, it goes wrong. So just enjoy the moment before you're making any plans, and then at least you can have some fun in your life, you know, the present moment. So that way, you just allow things to happen. You can be in harmony. Because the opposite of harmony is when you fight and make war. And you have enemies. So have you got an enemy of the past? Is the future your enemy? I think you can understand what I mean. Because if your past is an enemy, in the sense that there's business there, there's trouble, you're afraid of that past. But if you can be in harmony with your past, it becomes your friend. You can value it, learn from it. If your future is your enemy, you're really afraid of what might happen next. And it is an enemy. Then you're not living in harmony. You have a big problem. So see if you can change your attitude to be in harmony with the future and the past, to be friends to these things. And I'm a friend to the future because I think it's really interesting to see what happens next. But there's also that confidence. And no matter what happens next, you can always deal with it. If it's very difficult, it's great, and it's something which you can really learn from. Because for me, the meaning of life, you know, is to grow, to learn, to become a better person. Sometimes I need those challenges to become a better person. If you don't have those challenges, those difficulties in your life, those struggles, I mean, where are you ever going to learn? You just get fat and lazy. Well, I may be fat, but I'm not lazy. I promise that. So at the very least, you know, you're struggling and you're learning. So when something difficult happens in my life, yeah, I learn from that. I grow from that. Become a better monk because of that. And it's very difficult being a monk. There's many, many things which you have to bear with being a monk and dealing with things. And what's happened in the last week? Oh, we had all these lightning strikes in this monastery and you had to fix them all up, and difficulties which happen. Sometimes people complain about you. Sometimes they complain that, you know, you don't tell enough jokes. It's boring. Sometimes you tell old jokes and it's boring. And sometimes, you know, it's too exciting. Sometimes you don't talk long enough. Sometimes too short. Sometimes you should... Sometimes it's so difficult that many times in your life it's the same. But, you know, I'm a public person. You have to sit up here in front of people. So whatever you do in your life, you know, I know it doesn't really matter. There's always something you can make out of what you've got. I know that's, again, the Buddhist law of karma. And that's why it's much easier in my life to become a Buddhist, because I know it doesn't matter what ingredients people throw at me at life, I can always make a beautiful cake. That's happened many times. I don't know, I remember when I was a student, I had to sort of learn how to cook because I couldn't afford to go to a restaurant. So sometimes you'd look, you know, and see what was in the cupboard, and you couldn't go to any shops, you know, to buy what was needed. You just, you know, threw together whatever you had. And, you know, there are some people like that. You know, they look inside the cupboard and it's just, you know, stuff which, you know, most people think you can't make a meal out of that. And they put it all together and they make a delicious meal. Some people are just so good at doing that with, you know, whatever's there, you can make something interesting to eat. And that's actually the meaning of my life and the meaning, I think, your life as well. Whatever you have to work with in life, don't go to the shops and try and get something more in your life. You've got enough ingredients as it is. Learn how to put them together. It's good enough. And it's amazing, with that degree of kindness and love and effort, a lot of time inspiration. It's amazing what you can make out of what you've got. And I've been doing that for a long, long time. And that's what you can do, and that's what makes a beautiful life. It's being that inspiration. Yes, it can be done. Let's do it. So you're actually a friend to your adversity. The fact you haven't got the same ingredients as other people have got. That it's not all perfect. It doesn't matter. Be a friend to what you've got, not an enemy. And then you find it's amazing what you can put together in your life. So this is actually how we learn to live together in harmony with the past, with the future. And of course, the most difficult person to live together in harmony. It's very easy to be in harmony with other monks and nuns. It's very easy to be in harmony, you know, with your friends from the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church and the Muslims and the Jews or whatever. It's very easy to learn to be in harmony with other people. But the most difficult person to live in harmony with, to be friends with, is yourself. And that's one of the reasons many people come here, because again, we do have an enemy, our last enemy, or rather the enemy number one, which is ourselves. And that's so sad. Now, why are you an enemy to yourself? It's okay to be an enemy to someone else. You know, you can run away from them. You know, you can divorce your wife. You know, you can leave the Buddhist society and you can walk out of this door. But the one person you can never get away from is yourself. Wherever you go, there you are. I know that many people try to get away from themselves with alcohol and drugs and even suicide. But Buddhists don't believe in suicide. The reason is because we reincarnate. So imagine you kill yourself and there you are afterwards. Even, yeah, damn it. Still can't get away from myself. So that's very, very difficult. So what's that other suicide joke? This is a classic one. I say this because there's lots of monks here. Because they're monks from overseas, they probably haven't heard these jokes before. That's why I take the opportunity to say. You know the guy who was a painter here in Perth, and he had his motorbike accident, and as a result they had to amputate his hand, and that was the hand he used for painting. And it wasn't just like losing his hand, it was losing his profession and the one thing in life which he loved, painting. So as soon as he was released from hospital, he decided life was not living, not worth living, and he decided he had to just to end his life. So he went into the CBD here in Perth, St. George's Terrace. He went up into the elevator to one of these big buildings on a top story, went out onto the window ledge, and was about to jump off to end his life because he'd lost his hand. And as he was about to jump off, he looked down and saw along the street this man with no arms at all, dancing for joy. And he couldn't understand what was going on. Here he was, he'd only lost one hand, and there was a man with no arms at all, dancing for joy. And he realized it wasn't such a bad thing losing one hand. Life was still worth living. So he gave up his suicide wish, went off from the ledge, went into the elevator. As quickly as he could, he went down to the street and ran after that man with no arms. It was very easy to see and catch. And when he saw that man with no arms, he thanked him. He said, "Look, I was about to kill myself, and I saw you. You saved my life. I saw you with no arms at all, dancing for joy. It gave my life meaning. I've only lost one hand. You've lost both arms. How do you do that? How do you dance for joy with no arms? Teach me." Yeah, you don't know the punchline, don't you? Very funny. He said, look, he said, "I wasn't dancing for joy. I was just trying to scratch my bum." How else could someone with no arms deal with an itchy bottom? But anyway, just jumping up to... But that... When we make friends with adversity rather than as an enemy, it's amazing what we can do in life. So look, I don't know what's happened to you in your life. Well, those people listening sort of, you know, overseas, whatever's happened to you in your life, but there is always the possibility, the opportunity to live in harmony with your past, future and present, to live in harmony with yourself in the same way these Buddhist monks and nuns live in perfect harmony here this evening from different lands, different traditions, different genders. And Buddhism is very different in different countries. You just go there, different rituals, even different teachings, you know, different aims and goals. Yeah, there are so many differences, but there's so much we can value in each other. There's so much you can value in your past and your future. So much you can value in your present. Don't make it an enemy, make it a friend. And you, this person you can never run away with. You can run away with it, but not run away from it. You can never run away from you. So see if you can change the perception of yourself as an enemy into yourself as a friend. And how do you do that? Look for the things inside you which you can value and respect. In the same way that I could respect a shrine to Jesus, the same way I can respect a person who's murdered, the same way I can respect the difficulties which sometimes, you know, you have to face, you respect that. From respect, seeing something, not totally respecting, see something in there you can respect, valuing it, seeing its purpose, its meaning. And then there's a sense of harmony. That's why the thing which I found so difficult when I was training as a monk in Thailand was the mosquitoes. Now, it's very easy for you to say, "Oh, they're only little mosquitoes." Those were huge mosquitoes, mega mosquitoes, over in that part of Thailand. They're about this big. True. And we never had any protection. I say that you guys have your head protected by your hair. Imagine, no hair at all. We always used to wear this bare shoulder. So you see, all this shoulder and the back and the whole arms were just open, an open invitation for the mosquitoes. To put it bluntly, there was more seats at the dinner table on the monks. And no mosquito coils, no stuff you can put on, you know, a mosquito repellent, no fly screens. And worst of all, I don't know why Ajahn Chah did this. The first few months in Thailand, we would meditate outside at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. That was the time that the mosquitoes came out for dinner. And that was so terrible because, number one, you know, you had all this bare skin. And worse than that, this was, as I keep saying, the first time in that part of Thailand there were Western monks. The first time the mosquitoes had Western food. I know what it's like when there's a new cuisine in town. You know, Italian or Chinese or Korean. Whenever there's a new cuisine, you'd like to taste it there. So all these mosquitoes were telling their friends, hey guys, there's Western food at this particular forest monastery, let's come and test. So they had so many mosquitoes there. And even worse than that, the mosquitoes in Buddhist countries, there's got like an evolution, like a knowledge which is passed on from generation to generation, that when you see a brown robe, you're safe. And they take advantage of that. We're not allowed to swat them. They see you guys and they don't know whether that's going to be their last dinner or not. But for us, they can really relax. Imagine having going to a restaurant not knowing if you're going to come out alive. That's what it's like, a mosquito biting you. So they must get indigestion because of anxiety when they drink your blood, but not with monk's blood. They can drink it and take as long as they like because they know they're not going to get swatted. So look, it was so bad that we would complain to our teacher. We keep on saying, look, there is such a thing as mosquito repellent. Remember, you know, this is not the time of the Buddha. You know, things are advanced. They can sell it in the shops in Bangkok. Can't we get some? Please. And he said, no. And he said, from now on, he said, you will call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. Ajahn means teacher. They are your masters, your meditation teachers from now on. They are your little Buddha. Learn from them. Thank you very much. But, you know, like most of the time, these great monks, they're just so wise that after a while you can't criticize them, because that was true. I learned so much from Ajahn Mosquito. I did. What I learned from them is amazing. This is a little trick in meditation. I learned to totally relax and just to watch my breath and forget about those mosquitoes. Forget about them until you went so deep in your meditation you couldn't feel the mosquitoes anymore. And you can do that because, you know, you have to. Sometimes when you focus on these problems and troubles, they just occupy your whole mind. There's other parts of life than your troubles and problems. And if we just keep focusing on all the terrible things which have happened to us in the past, all the things which might happen to us in the future, what matters then is that we forget the rest of life. So by focusing on the mosquitoes, I was forgetting everything else which was happening. So I just put the mosquitoes aside, focused on things like my breathing and my peace, and the mosquitoes vanished. And I thought at the time, when I came out of those meditations, there were no sort of like bumps on the arm. You know, when you get bitten by a mosquito, there's a little welt. There was no welts there at all. And I thought this was some magic power meditation. Only later on I realized the thing which attracts mosquitoes to you is the carbon dioxide coming from your pores. The more frantic and anxious you get, the higher your metabolism, the more carbon dioxide comes out, and the more the mosquitoes know you're there. When you really relax, I mean really relax, and your metabolism goes down as it does in meditation, then you become invisible to the mosquitoes. I learned from Ajahn Mosquito how to relax, even in irritating physical conditions. Thank you, Ajahn Mosquito. In those adversities, those difficulties, I learned something of value. Like you can, whatever happens to you in your life. So please, be a friend to adversity, to difficulties, to pain. Be a friend to also the peace and happiness you have in life. Learn the secret of harmony. And if you can learn that secret of harmony by valuing everything, then you know how to value yourself and be at peace with yourself. Harmony is the essence of things. See if you can be in harmony with your life. Thank you for listening. So now we have the first questions. They were on a minute ago, Bo, from overseas. We have the first question, Buddy Siri from Sri Lanka. Dear Ajahn, does eating meat break my first precept, and does refraining lead to the growth of sila that helps my meditation? Thank you. Eating meat doesn't break your first precept, because sometimes I ate, actually over here, many times about a month or two ago, I ate flies. I just opened my mouth and one went in. No intention there at all. No, it's, as one person said, which is most important, the worst thing in life is not actually what you put into your mouth, it's what comes out of it. It's a very powerful saying there. So if you can lessen your meat consumption or not take meat, refrain, then that does lead to the growth of sila, and it does help in your meditation, simply because, you know, you're refraining, you're letting go. You know, you're not taking the easy option. You know, you're beginning to have some degree of discipline. So that really does help. So is that the only question there, Bo? Only from Sri Lanka? It looks like it on this little... Yep, that's it. Okay, are there any questions from the floor? Yes. So someone has left their lights on, so you won't be able to go home. So instead, you can stay here for the night, but the only way you can stay here is to become a monk or a nun. So in your adversity of not having a car to come home, you have got the great good fortune of ordaining as one of the members of the Sangha. So well done. I say even in adversity, there's something of value. So well done. So... what's the number again? XPG888. Okay, that must be a Chinese person's car. You know that because 8 is the lucky number, and 888 is very difficult to get. So please look after your car. So, any questions about living in harmony between people? So, look, let's go a bit further. Oh, we've got one over there. Yes, okay. Yes.
Yes, I was just wondering if yourself doesn't exist, or if how can you be an enemy of yourself if the self doesn't exist? Is that possible?
So could you repeat that?
Yes. How can you be an enemy of yourself if the self doesn't exist?
Okay. How can you be in harmony with yourself if yourself does not exist? Is that right?
How can you be
an enemy of yourself if yourself doesn't exist? Yeah, if you think you exist, that's a problem. I'm not saying whether you do exist or not, but if you think you do exist, then it's easy to become an enemy of this thing you think you are. That's the problem, you know, with thinking too much, because thinking too much, you know, actually just creates our world, creates our future, creates our present also. And so it's very easy to say, oh, there is no self. You may say that as a philosophy, but if I say you're the most foolish person in the whole world, you know, who taught you that? You don't know anything about non-self. And if you say, what? Why do you say such things to me? It shows that you have got a self. That is actually why it's very easy for a person to say there's no self. But actually to live it is a much more different thing. That's why there's this classic story about being an enemy of yourself, or not being an enemy of yourself, or understanding no self. This actually is the usual the way we try and teach people about understanding whether you're enlightened or not. It's a classic way of monks. If someone comes up to you and says, yes, they've become this state of enlightenment or this state of enlightenment, we always try to upset them and make them angry. Because if you get angry, it shows that you have a sense of self which has been offended. So the classic story is of the monk, the Chinese monk, who asked his abbot in his monastery to see if he could become a hermit. He said that I've learnt all of the sutras. You know, I've done my basic training in meditation and keeping the monastic precepts. But now I want to go for full enlightenment. And he said that not far away from the monastery, there is a beautiful uninhabited island. Can I have permission to build a small, simple hut and to live there? All I would ask is that one of the attendants at the monastery just rows over to the island once a week to give me supplies, just simple food which I can cook for myself, so I can live in harmony and peace with seeing hardly anybody as a hermit, just wanting to become enlightened. So the abbot said, yes, I can arrange that for you. So this monk went to that island and lived in ideal solitude for 3 years, just being visited by the attendant once a week. And after 3 years, he decided he was fully enlightened. And so he wanted to tell the abbot. And he wondered how should he tell the abbot of his great attainment. So when the attendant came, the monk asked him for three things: for some paper, some ink, and a pen. He wanted to write some calligraphy. 1 week later, the parchment, ink, and pen came. And the monk sat in deep meditation all day. And when he came out of meditation, he wrote in exquisite calligraphy the following poem in four lines. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Now, not being moved by the four worldly winds is understood by the monks to mean a claim of full enlightenment. Whatever happens in the world, you're not moved. And so, having written in beautiful calligraphy, he rolled up the scroll, and when the attendant came the next time, he gave the scroll to the attendant with the instructions to give it to the abbot. The abbot would surely realize that his student was now another fully enlightened monk. 1 week later, the reply came from the abbot. The same scroll. And when the monk on the island opened the scroll, his eyes went wide with shock. It was his poem, carefully written. But over the first line, the diligent monk, was written in red ballpoint pen, the four letters, F-A-R-T. He looked at the second line, alone for 3 years, and there was the same four letters, but this time in capitals, F-A-R-T. And the third line is no longer moved. Was F-A-R-T underlined by the four worldly winds, and this time a huge F-A-R-T, triple underlined with three exclamation marks afterwards. That had ruined his calligraphy. More than that, that stupid old abbot couldn't understand someone who was enlightened, and he was so upset. He ran to the boat, and the attendant hadn't quite left yet. So he jumped in the boat and ordered the attendant to take him to that stupid abbot to tell him that you can't do this thing to an enlightened monk. And this beautiful calligraphy, he's messed it up. It's like graffiti. It's not really a monk, it's a punk. So he went over to see that abbot. And he sort of stormed into the room. He slammed the piece of parchment on the table and said, explain yourself. Look what you've done. And the abbot very slowly and calmly stood up, and he opened the scroll and he read the poem. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet, monk, four little farts have blown you clean across the lake. That's an old story, but that's how easy to test somebody. If you really know and understand there's no self, then you have no enemy. But if there's some lingering perception of a me, someone in there, then you can have an enemy. So be careful. Actually, we've got from two questions. One from Pakistan now. Metta from Pakistan. What do you do if you're from a conservative Muslim family and they want you dead because you choose the Buddhist path? If you come from a conservative Muslim family and they want you dead because you choose the Buddhist path, it's... Maybe if that was me, what I'd probably do, I would, you know, practice that Buddhist path, but don't call it Buddhism. Just change its packaging, but just keep its essence. You know, of kindness, peace, love, respect. And I think that if you change the packaging, I think they will respect you. And they won't want you dead. And maybe after many years, once they see what a good person you are, what a kind person you are, then maybe... Then you can tell them, oh, I'm a Buddhist. And they realize that I've been a Buddhist all these years. And then they realize, oh, this Buddhism can't be such a bad thing because you're such a great person, a good person. So maybe that might be an opportunity there. From Annie in New York, what is Buddhism's point of view on science by research, cloning research on fruits or plants or humans? As far as Buddhism is concerned, there's no problem there at all. With cloning, because there is a little article which I published some time ago on where the Buddha said that the human being starts when consciousness first descends into the mother's womb, and when that happens, they say that consciousness becomes manifest in the mother's womb. In other words, it's apparent. So that being growing in the mother's womb has to show signs of reacting to pain and pleasure. When it's a small embryo in a sort of a petri dish, there is obviously no reaction to pain or pleasure. The nervous system hasn't developed yet. So quite clearly, that's not the start of a human life yet. Potential yet, but it's not counted as a human life. So even like theologically, you know, there is no problem at all with using embryos, unfertilized eggs or fertilized eggs even, which have not yet developed for cloning. What a wonderful thing that is, because that can create so many cures for diseases and can lessen the pain and suffering which so many people experience in this world. It's a very beautiful thing to do. So cloning research on fruits or plants or humans, there's no problem there at all. Obviously, that as long as it's not harming the humans or the animals, because I remember as a young man learning about in some research labs, they were doing experiments. The worst thing I ever read was on monkeys. They were testing out helmets for U.S. football, I think the gridiron football, because that's a very violent sport. And to avoid head injuries when you're playing, you know, the American football, all of the athletes or the players there would wear these helmets, and they would test out these helmets on monkeys, first of all, by putting a monkey on and smashing this monkey's head against a wall. I think that was totally unacceptable. So, you know, for other research, I've known now that I think many people are very careful about not supporting animal sort of research on drugs, cosmetics. And there's no need to these days, because apparently what I've been told by scientists in the field is there's other ways of modelling, other ways of finding out whether these drugs or whatever else you're using has an effect on the human tissue. You don't need to have animal testing anymore. So I'm not really approve of that. But if it's... yes, go on.
On that line, animal testing, I don't know whether anybody else here saw it, but there was a program on TV this week.
Program on TV in Australia this week on animal testing.
And they actually transplanted heads between two monkeys.
Transplanted heads between two monkeys.
The monkeys lived afterwards for I don't know how long.
Yeah.
But they said that regardless of how long they'd lived, they'd never have any movement below their
neck. Yes, okay. So they transplanted monkey heads and they didn't have any movement. That doesn't seem to be a very ethical thing to do. No. Certainly I wouldn't do that. But I know that people do experiments on the monks. I know that many women, they try out new recipes on us, first of all, before they give it to their husbands. Because they know we won't divorce them. So anyway, so I think we'll finish off now because it's 9 o'clock and we're going to shortly have some celebrations. I think there is some food to eat outside as well for some people. But anyway, first of all, we're going to have some announcements from Dennis and then we can enjoy the celebrations for the Chinese New Year.